Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, registered dietitian Brenda Davis. Brenda Davis is a respected researcher and an internationally acclaimed speaker. She's the best-selling co-author of 9 books. Her most recent book, Becoming Vegan Express Edition, won a 2013 Canada Book Award and was recently selected by Forward Reviews Magazine as a 2013 Book of the Year Award finalist. For the last 7 years, Brenda has been the lead dietitian in a heavily studied diabetes intervention project in the Marshall Islands. She is a past chair of the Vegetarian Nutrition Dietetic Practice Group of the American Dietetic Association, and one of the world's foremost experts on healthy nutrition and plant-strong diets. So now, Brenda, my dad and I are so excited to have the benefit of your insights today. And now for the interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Thanks so much, Ocean, for that lovely introduction. It's a real privilege to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you, Brenda, and it's an honor always to bring your voice and wisdom and heartfulness to our audience.
Thank you.
And to as many people as can hear it, because they always benefit. I want to start by asking you about a couple of currently very best-selling books titled Wheat Belly and Grain Brain. In these books, grains, and particularly wheat, are blamed for just about every kind of health problem imaginable. According to the authors of these books, the road to health is strict carbohydrate restriction. How valid is the evidence they present to support their views?
Well, to be fair, John, I actually haven't read Perlmutter's Grain Brain. I have read Wheat Belly, but I am familiar with the claims and the work of both of these authors. But to be honest, I think the claims are exaggerated, and I also think they're highly flawed. To me, you know, I think the acid test for any of these kinds of broad sweeping claims about diet and health is really to look at how the claims hold up relative to the diets of the longest living, healthiest populations on the planet. And those are populations like you described in Healthy at 100 or the populations of the blue zones. And to me, if grains and, you know, more specifically gluten, were as deadly as these authors actually claim they are, the populations that rely on them as dietary staples would be experiencing, you know, really high mortality rates, high rates of disease, high rates of dementia. And both of the books really fail the acid test quite miserably. You know, if you look at these populations, almost all of them use grains as dietary staples. Those that don't, like the traditional Okinawan Japanese, use other high carbohydrate foods as dietary staples, like sweet potatoes. So if you look at Perlmutter's Grain Brain, if you look at what he's actually recommending, he's recommending a diet of 75% of calories from fat, 5% from carbs. And he claims that this reflects the diet of early man. And I just, you know, I look at those claims and I just can't even understand how he comes up with those figures. To me, they're just nonsense. I'm not sure where the fat would even come from. If you look at the diet of a Paleolithic man, it was wild plants and wild animals. Even the wild animals were only 10 to 16% of calories from fat. It would almost be impossible to design a diet with that much fat without pouring oil all over everything. There was no oil in those days. So it just doesn't make sense that if you look at nutritional anthropology and you look at the estimates of what these people actually ate, the estimates are 20 to 25% of calories from fat and 45 to 50% of calories from carbohydrates. You know, if you actually followed Perlmutter's advice, you would be eating maybe 50, 60 grams of carbohydrate a day. The Institute of Medicine has actually set the RDA for carbohydrates at 130 grams a day. And this really is considered the minimum amount necessary for the brain to function adequately. So it just doesn't make sense to me. And it's interesting if you look at wheat belly and the claims about gluten as well. There's actually a one population of the blue zones that is the Seventh-day Adventist of Loma Linda, California, that actually eat more gluten than most people because they eat these gluten-based mock meats. And there was a study done of that particular population, and the rates of dementia in the vegetarians of that population were about half the rates of dementia in the meat eaters. So, you know, I think like with most of the popular diet books and other low-carb books, which are very popular today, there is a grain of truth to their claim. But to me, the grain of truth is really about refined carbohydrates. Both starches and sugars, when you refine them, can be damaging to human health, especially for people who chronically overeat like most Americans do. These foods increase triglycerides, they contribute to inflammation, they cause elevated blood glucose levels. But when you look at grains that are intact, like whole grains, they are pretty consistently linked with health benefits. They're not the most nutrient-dense food on the planet, like vegetables, for example, but they still make a pretty valuable contribution to the world's nutrient needs. To sum up, I think what people really need to bear in mind is that any low-carb diet is a low-plant diet because all plants contain carbohydrates. Even non-starchy vegetables are 50 to 80% of their calories from carbohydrates. So low-carbohydrate diets are essentially high meat and egg diets, and they're very low in the dietary components that are most strongly linked with disease risk reduction, like fiber and phytochemicals and antioxidants and prebiotics and plant sterols and, you know, the nutrients that are concentrated in plant foods, like vitamin C and folate and potassium. They're high in a lot of the more pathogenic dietary components, like hormones and antibiotics and saturated fat and even possibly carnitine, all of the probiotics, like the persistent organic pollutants and heavy metals and heterocyclic amines and so on and so forth. So I think if we're really going to succeed at creating a safe and adequate food supply to nourish a growing population, we've got to start looking at the big picture. And an animal-heavy diet is not only unhealthy for people, it's ecologically unsustainable and it's very ethically misguided. I think it's a disaster for people in the planet, and it really troubles me to see how popular these programs are becoming. It's just scary.
When you mention the Seventh-day Adventists, they're among the most carefully studied group in the world in terms of their diets and health outcomes, and many of them are vegetarian, and as you mentioned, they do rely on meat substitutes made from seitan, a gluten product. So their intake of gluten is higher than the average, yet they live longer and healthier lives, quite a bit healthier lives and quite a bit longer than the average in the United States. But there's a gluten mystery here, I think, because on the one hand, we have that data. We have the fact that bread has a long, distinguished culinary and cultural history. Even in our language, the word for money has been dough. Or bread. We talk about the staff of life, but to many people today, what has long been considered the staff of life is now being considered the root of disease, and many people are reporting health improvements when they reduce or eliminate gluten. And I think I have a clue to what is actually taking place. The time-honored art and science of grain breeding, of developing new varieties of grains and of wheat, has been completely taken over today by large seed and milling and baking interests. And they've bred wheat varieties which are used commercially today specifically to work with fast-rising commercial yeasts. Most industrial bakeries just allow bread to rise for a couple of minutes at most, which cuts their production costs, but it's not nearly long enough to let the yeast digest the gluten in the flour. Microbes need time to break down the gluten and free up the nutrients. When they aren't given enough time, and they aren't in today's industrial baking, the result can be all kinds of problems in our guts. I see the mystery that's taking place. I hear a lot of people saying, well, when I gave up gluten, I saw improvements. And I think there might be another piece to it, too, which is that there are ingredients used in modern bread manufacturing that are downright scary. You can't judge a bread by its color today because bread companies create the color often using additives. And even those breads sold as natural and ultra-healthy often contain chemicals that are difficult to pronounce.
Right.
Given the realities of modern bread baking, Brenda, and the many reactions people are having to gluten, what's your recommendation? Should people experiment with giving up gluten in order to find out if their health improves from doing so?
You know, it makes sense to me that people who think they might be gluten sensitive experiment. I think that we are seeing more problems with gluten sensitivity than we ever did before. And there is concern about, you know, how we're eating our grain products. And I think you've certainly hit on a lot of the issues, but also 90 to 95% of the grains people eat in North America are probably fairly highly refined and processed, which means most of the things that are of value in those foods are stripped from them before we eat them. I don't think grains are absolutely essential foods, but they are so important for feeding the world. They provide, you know, a large portion of the protein and energy that the world's population requires. And I think you can design a diet to be adequate using, you know, starchy vegetables, for example, instead of grains. But I don't think we really need to eliminate them. And I think they are valuable for most people. So when I say intact grains, I'm talking about grains as they're picked off the plant. For example, the way that I eat grains for breakfast is I sprout them. So I eat sprouted kamut berries for breakfast or sprouted spelt berries. But remember that there are a lot of grains that don't contain gluten at all, like quinoa and amaranth and wild rice and millet. You know, so there are a number of things that people can consume in place of gluten-containing grains, but really give it a fair chance. And I think once you've eliminated your gluten-containing grains, then the next step would be to start to add them back, but add them back carefully. Start with sprouted whole grains and then go to intact whole grains like barley in a soup. And before you start to add back any of the more heavily processed grains, because it may be those heavily processed grains that are really causing you the problem.
It seems to me that any time wheat is ground into flour, we get into problems.
Absolutely.
Yet, bread has been a vital food source for peoples around the globe for perhaps 4,000 years. We have records of breads being baked, raised breads, yeasted breads being baked
right.
in Egypt around 4,000 BC. But today's breads, even the ones that are sold as 100% whole wheat and marketed as ultra-healthy, often contain many chemicals that aren't in the ingredient list on the package. There's a particular chemical called azodicarbonamide. It's used to make yoga mats in flip-flops and rubber gaskets and foam insulation. It's used in the plastics industry as a rubberizing agent. You wouldn't think such a chemical would be in bread, but one of our Food Revolution Summit speakers, Vonnie Hari, who's also known as Food Babe, brought to light that this chemical, azodicarbonamide, is now being used in almost all commercial U.S. breads, including those that are marketed as 100% whole wheat and healthy. The bakeries in the United States use it to provide strength and elasticity to bread dough. Even though it is banned as a food additive in the UK and throughout Europe and Australia, if you get caught using it in Singapore, you can get up to 15 years in prison. But our bread bakers, our commercial bread bakers use it routinely. Subway uses it and markets their bread as 100% healthy. I think that the corporate takeover of bread making has created problems in people's guts. We really need to get away from the corporate control of our food supply.
You know, the take-home message there has got to be, if you want to eat bread, make your own. It's not that difficult to do, and at least you can control what's going in it. I guess from a personal perspective, that's you know, what I've done in most of what we consume. I make things from scratch. And in order to allow yourself to do that, you have to make food preparation a real priority in your life and take time for it. And it can be something that's quite joyful as well when you do take time to make foods from scratch and really control what's going into what you're eating.
You mentioned that you sprout kamut and spelt. Our listeners might not be familiar with those grains.
Okay. Well, kamut and spelt are considered ancient grains, and they really are part of the wheat family. They nutritionally are fairly similar to wheat, and even in gluten content aren't much different from wheat. But they are grains that a lot of people who have a sensitivity to wheat somehow seem to be able to tolerate better. And I prefer using them. I like the flavor. I like to sprout them. And I think that nutritionally, there's a little bit of an advantage there.
We have abundant evidence, compelling evidence, that a whole foods, plant-strong diet is decisively associated with health promotion and disease prevention. We also have a very popular paleo diet that you mentioned a few minutes ago.
Right.
To me, the idea that what our ancient ancestors ate might be a good reference by which we could appraise what we should eat today makes some sense. Reducing processed foods, sugar, and dairy, which paleo diets do, strikes me as all to the good.
Yeah.
But the composition of modern meat is nothing like that of the wild game that was eaten by hunter-gatherers. And many of the plants that were available during the Stone Age are today extinct. I wonder how much correspondence there actually is between the diets recommended by the paleo authors and what our ancient ancestors actually ate during the Paleolithic period.
This is definitely an area of interest for me. I remember when all of this kind of came to light and the paleo diets really started to take hold among consumers and people at the gyms, especially CrossFit people and so forth. I got really curious, and so I decided to take a look at the nutritional anthropology and see if I could better understand what people during Paleolithic times actually consumed. Because like you, John, I feel that there's got to be something that we could learn from people of that era. And so I took a look, and I found a paper that estimated the intakes of Paleolithic people. And, of course, we're talking about thousands of years of various diets and people all over the world eating different things. But I think the estimates are probably reasonably good. And what I found, the paper that did the best job that I could see of really providing a detailed analysis or estimate of these diets, just absolutely stunned me. Because they estimated fiber intakes at 104 grams a day. They estimated vitamin C intakes at over 600 milligrams a day. Calcium at almost 2,000 milligrams a day. Potassium was over 10,000 milligrams a day. And for anybody that knows about these nutrients, fiber comes only from plants. Most vegans eat about 40 to 50 grams a day. Vitamin C is from fruits and vegetables. The average North American maybe gets 100 or 150 milligrams. You know, calcium, I mean, they didn't consume any dairy products. They didn't consume the milk of any mammals, and yet they were getting 2,000 milligrams a day. Potassium, it comes mainly from fruits and vegetables, and they were getting, you know, far in excess of what most people get. They were getting over 10,000 milligrams, and most people are lucky if they get 2,000 or 3,000 milligrams.
Where were they getting all that calcium from?
And that's the question. They were getting it from plants, and largely from green leafy plants. They get a little bit from bones, but most of it was coming from plants. And, you know, that was my first thought, is these people are eating truckloads of plants. It's unbelievable. These numbers are unbelievable. My second thought was, people eating these so-called paleo diets of today are eating truckloads of meat. They're not getting anywhere close to these numbers. So I thought, I've got to take a look at what these people are actually eating. So I went to one of the most popular paleo websites I could find, and I took 3 consecutive days of their recommended menus, and I actually analyzed them, carefully analyzed them, and I compared that analysis to the estimates of paleo diets, and they were so far off it wasn't even funny. I was just stunned at how far off they were. And then I took 3 days of recommended vegan menus, which are basically 100% plant-based diets. And in both cases, I adjusted the menu so that they were calorically equivalent to the true paleo diet, so about 3,000 calories. And the result was that the vegan menus were so much closer to the paleo diets than were these so-called paleo diets today. The only thing the paleo diets were closer on was protein. They were both about 30% of calories from protein. And they were a little bit closer on vitamin A and zinc. And otherwise, all of the other nutrients, carbohydrates, fat, saturated fat, even the ratio of essential fatty acids, fiber, riboflavin, thiamine, vitamin C, vitamin E, you know, most of the minerals like calcium, sodium, potassium, iron, actually were all closer on a vegan diet. And I thought, boy, this is really something. Why would this be when what the new paleo people are eating, you know, they're eating meat and plants, and that's what people in Paleolithic times were eating. But you nailed the nail on the head when you said that the real difference is that the meat that people consume today, the domestic animals, which are probably 40 to 60% of calories from fat, are nothing like the wild animals of the Paleolithic period, which might have had 10 to 16% of calories from fat. Even the plants, like you say, most of them are, or many of them are extinct today. They were very different than the plants that we've bred to be very appealing to humans. We pick the plants that are the sweetest and the easiest to eat and the least fibrous and so on. And, you know, we've bred them to be that way. And so even the plants are very different than the plants that were eaten in those times. And if you look at the amount of, for example, carbohydrate that is being consumed by the people eating a sort of this new paleo diet, they're eating about 15% of calories from carbs. It was about 45 to 50% in the true paleo era. These guys that are doing the new paleo diets are eating over 50% of calories from fat and almost 20% of calories from saturated fat. And in the Paleolithic era, estimates were about 20 to 25% fat and about 6% saturated fat. So just absolutely no comparison. And even if we could effectively recreate a paleo diet today, eating wild plants and wild animals, we couldn't effectively recreate it for the 7 billion people that live on this planet. There were maybe a few million people wandering around in those days. If everyone tried to eat the kind of paleo diet that people are eating right now, I would estimate we'd need 10 planet Earths to sustain the current population. It's just not environmentally or ecologically sustainable by any stretch of the imagination. And the other thing that I think we have to consider is if when you look at what people on the paleo diet are eating today, the amount of animal products they're eating, what would that mean in terms of animal agriculture? As it is, we're slaughtering 10 or 11 billion animals in North America alone. What would we quadruple that? Where would we put those animals and how would we possibly be raising them in any way that would make any sense ethically? It's just, I think people get so consumed with themselves that they forget to stop and look at the bigger picture. We need to be producing food for over 7 billion people. So that,
well, you mentioned saturated fat a couple of times, and it brought to my mind the very recently published meta-analysis that was in the Journal Annals of Internal Medicine.
Yeah.
It looked at 72 different studies, and it found, surprisingly to some, no association between saturated fat consumption and heart disease. Yeah. Now, the researchers are saying that more work, including more clinical studies, are needed, but radio hosts are saying that we no longer need to worry about eating big steaks with cheese on top. What's the truth, Brenda? Is butter back?
This is so concerning because I know even here in Kelowna, our radio announcers were basically saying I no longer have to feel guilty about my big steak with cheese on top. So it's causing a lot of concern among people who know better. But I have to tell you, there have been two huge meta-analyses. One, 2010, which, you know, 21 studies, 350,000 people. This last one was over 500,000 people, and I believe it was actually 76 studies they looked at. But what people need to understand is many of these meta-analyses were comparing populations eating a lot of high-fat, high-saturated fat diets with people eating diets that were even higher in saturated fats. And the studies that actually examine a sort of a more diverse range of saturated fat intakes tend to show significantly greater differences in disease risks. Now, the other thing that people should note is that many of the studies included in these meta-analyses actually adjusted for serum cholesterol levels. I'm no expert in stats, but it seems like a bit of a no-brainer. You can't really adjust for a variable that is on the causal pathway between exposure and outcome and expect it not to obscure results. I couldn't believe they did that, but they did. The other thing that people have to understand is we've got 50 years worth of very hard data that very clearly demonstrates that saturated fat increases blood cholesterol levels and that high blood cholesterol levels are a major risk factor for coronary artery disease. And we have probably a dozen meta-analyses. Nine of them showed saturated fat increases risk of heart disease. Only three didn't. We actually had a consensus expert panel come up with consensus statement on saturated fat and cardiovascular disease risk. The consensus was that we have plenty of information to prove that when you replace saturated fat with polyunsaturated fat, it actually reduces risk of coronary heart disease by about, when you replace 1% of saturated fat with 1% of polyunsaturated fat, you lower the risk by 2 to 3%. Now, here's the real clincher. This latest 2014 study by Choudhury was a study that showed no association or no significant association between saturated fat intake and disease risk. I contacted Dr. Francesca Crowe, who was one of the co-authors of that study, and I contacted her because she's been involved in Epic Oxford, which is the big study looking at the differences in disease rates between omnivores and vegetarians and so forth. So I thought she might have some insight. And what she told me was shocking. First of all, she told me that this meta-analysis originally showed an association between saturated fat and heart disease risk, but it was not accepted in the first journal they submitted it to. They then reanalyzed the data using different ways of analysis, different means of analysis, and they came up with some different findings, and they resubmitted it, and it was accepted. This is what she said, and I think this is really, really important. She told me that the findings of this study do not change what we know. And what we know, and this is a direct quote, the best available evidence from randomized controlled clinical trials shows that saturated fat intake increases blood cholesterol levels, which is an important risk factor for heart disease. And she said, therefore, the current guidelines should still recommend that people minimize, and this is her words, not mine, minimize their intake of saturated fat. And that is from one of the co-authors of that study. And I think what we need to remember is that the media does not always tell the whole story. In the case of the meta-analyses that show that saturated fat has been vindicated, essentially what these studies are showing is that there is no real improvement in cardiovascular disease risk when we replace saturated fat with trans fatty acids and when we replace saturated fat with refined carbohydrates. However, when we replace saturated fat with polyunsaturated fat and when we replace saturated fat with unrefined carbohydrates, it's a whole different story. And that part of the story, for some reason, the media fails to tell.
I'm wondering if there might be changes if we replaced some saturated fat with other forms of saturated fat even, because,
oh, absolutely.
For example, we get saturated fat in our diets, comes from dairy products, a lot of it from cheese and butter and ice cream. It also comes from meats. But it also comes from coconut and from palm oil, and it comes from chocolate. So, you know, I wonder if there are, might be differences in the health consequences or impacts from different saturated fat sources.
Oh, absolutely. And what we know at this point, I mean, we still have a lot to learn, but we know that the saturated fats that have 6 or 8 or 10 carbons in the saturated fat chain have less of an impact. We know that lauric acid, which is a 12-carbon saturated fat, does increase blood cholesterol levels, but it increases HDL more than LDL, and so it may not be quite as damaging as myristic acid and palmitic, which are 14 and 16 carbon chains, and those fats tend to increase cholesterol quite significantly. We also know that stearic acid has less impact on cholesterol, although it may have some negative impacts as well, but definitely less impact on blood cholesterol levels. So the different saturated fats definitely have different impacts. And, you know, most of the saturated fat in coconut is lauric acid. Not that we should be pouring coconut oil over our food. I think we should generally be sticking to whole foods, but I have done work in the Marshall Islands. The traditional Marshallese diet was 50 to 60% of calories came from coconut, and they were doing very well when they were eating that much coconut and coconut products. So I think that when we get our fat from whole foods, it's very different than when we get it from the concentrated fats and oils. Generally, I think that we want to reduce our total intake of saturated fat, but recognize that when it comes packaged with cholesterol and without fiber, it probably is a lot more damaging. Also, when it's packaged in the form of meat and dairy products, it's coming with other things. It's coming with pro-inflammatory molecules in meat like NU5GC. It's coming with hormones and antibiotics. And these foods tend to increase pathogenic microflora in our guts, which is problematic. It can increase the production of TMAO, especially in foods that are really rich in carnitine like meat. You know, products of oxidation when we cook meat. When we cook it, we're forming heterocyclic amines and polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons and advanced glycation end products. And all of those things can be problematic. So that saturated fat is coming with a lot of things that don't do anything of great value for human health.
So bottom line, which are the saturated fats that people most should avoid?
The saturated fats that are in meat and dairy products, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay. You and your co-authors have written the classic books, Becoming Vegetarian and Becoming Vegan, which show people who want to adopt plant-based diets how they can do so in the healthiest possible way. Now, you're coming out soon with a completely revised edition of your seminal classic, Becoming Vegan. I want to ask you, what's new? What are the latest findings? And what is most important for people who are embarking on a plant-strong journey to understand?
Okay. Well, first of all, I think what's really new is quite a lot, actually. We wrote our first Becoming Vegan in 2003, so it's been more than 10 years. But it's really been since 2011 that we finally have data that has compared the health of people consuming vegan diets with people consuming lacto-ovo vegetarian diets, with people consuming lacto-ovo vegetarian diets plus fish, people consuming semi-vegetarian diets, and meat eaters. And we've got two big cohorts. One is in the UK, and it's about 65,000 people. And we've been following these people for a long time. And the other cohort is actually in the United States and Canada, and this is about 96,000 people who are part of the Seventh-day Adventist community. And in both cases, we're comparing health-conscious, similar health-conscious individuals, and we're controlling for things like exercise and smoking and all kinds of lifestyle factors, which makes these studies of great interest. And so what we know at this point, and we've only known this since about 2011, a lot of the data came out in 2012, 2013, and is continuing to come out, so we'll learn more and more. But the most we've learned from Epic Oxford, we've learned that people eating vegetarian or vegan diets are about 32% or a third less likely to develop heart disease than health-conscious meat eaters. We've also learned, and this is from the same study, diverticular disease in vegetarians about 31% lower. And then from the Adventist Health Study, vegetarians and vegans have about 52% less kidney disease. If we look specifically at vegans, they have about 63% less hypertension, 61% less diabetes, and about 16% less cancer. And that compares to lacto-ovo vegetarians who have about 8% less cancer than meat eaters. And this is all compared to meat eaters. And vegan men are about half as likely to get heart disease as meat-eating men. So very, very interesting findings. Now, the problem, as we start to restrict our diets and we get more and more limited in the number of things that we're choosing, we get more concerned about nutritional adequacy.
I'm thinking also about essential fatty acids.
Yeah.
And one of them, alpha-linolenic acid, all essential fatty acids are called that because it's essential that we get them from food. The human body cannot make them. People eating plant-strong diets can get that fairly easily from flax seeds and soybeans and walnuts. But there are also longer-chain omega-3 essential fatty acids, in particular EPA and DHA, that are harder to get from plants. The human body can convert alpha-linolenic acid into EPA and into DHA, but the conversion rates have been thought to be low and unreliable and unpredictable. Fish and fish oils are the most concentrated sources of EPA and DHA in the human diet. Are people who don't eat fish or fish oil at risk of inadequate levels of these very important nutrients, EPA and DHA?
Yes, and the short answer is yes, absolutely. We know a fair bit about the levels in various populations, and there's no question that people who do not consume any animal products, particularly any fish or fish oil, actually have levels that are probably about half that of the average omnivore. The bottom line is that generally people who are avoiding fish are definitely have lower levels of the long-chain omega-3s. And the long-chain omega-3s are really pretty important. You know, long-chain omega-3 fatty acids are important for a number of things. They are important for our brains, for building brains, building nervous systems. They actually get into our cell membranes and they affect, you know, the flexibility, the permeability, the ability for cell-to-cell communication. They are precursors for eicosanoids and for resolvins and protectins that are extremely important for enhancing gene expression even. These are really important chemicals. And so when we don't get enough, it could end up compromising health in one way or another, whether it's cardiovascular disease risk or arthritis risk or autoimmune diseases or even cancer. We even have some evidence concerning dementia and diabetes and asthma and so forth. So the big question is, well, how do people who are not consuming fish, who are eating plant-strong diets, make sure that they get enough? And, of course, they can be consuming more of the chia seeds and flax seeds and hemp seeds and things that are good sources of omega-3s, and they can be putting a lid on omega-6s by not pouring omega-6-rich oils like sunflower and safflower and grapeseed oil all over their food. They can do these things. They can make sure that their diet is healthful and doesn't contain trans fatty acids, which impair conversion of the alpha-linolenic acid to EPA and DHA. There are all of these things that they can do, but there's something else that they can do as well, and that is that they can consume direct sources of EPA and DHA by consuming microalgae. And it's interesting, I was amazed to learn many years ago that fish don't make EPA and DHA. They get it at some point along the food chain from plants in the ocean called microalgae. And what's happening today is this kind of microalgae that's rich in EPA and DHA is actually being cultured. And when you culture microalgae, it's free of all of the environmental contaminants that are in the oceans. And so, of course, you know, fish is only as clean as the water it's swimming in, and the same for plants in the sea. But when you culture the plants, you can keep them very clean. And so we can get, you know, supplements of EPA and DHA now that are actually probably a better source of EPA and DHA for people who are pregnant and so forth, who want to make sure that their source is very clean. So that's one way of doing it. The problem is that these supplements are really quite expensive, and so it's not something that can be provided for the entire population at this point in time. What I suggest is people that are at greater risk, people who are pregnant or lactating who need more DHA and EPA, may want to be using 200 or 300 milligrams of DHA and EPA, mainly DHA for pregnant and lactating women.
Brenda, when it comes to cutting-edge nutritional information, you are always a reliable and thoughtful resource. Your work just helped millions of people to eat more healthy foods and to live more healthy lives. It's been, as always, a real pleasure to talk with you today. On behalf of all of us at the Food Revolution Network, I want to thank you for your years of outstanding work and for sharing some of it with us today.
Thank you so much, John. It's been such a privilege to be with you.
We've been talking with Brenda Davis, registered dietitian and best-selling author of 9 books, including Defeating Diabetes and Becoming Vegan Express Edition. Brenda, your deep study and decades of real-world practice are incredibly practical and powerfully useful. And I also want to honor where you're coming from in this work, because I know how deeply you want to help people be healthy, how much you care about humanity, and how much it breaks your heart to know that we can do so much better than we often are, that so much of the suffering that people are experiencing could be prevented. And I honor your passionate commitment to sharing the knowledge that can help people to thrive and your partnership in the food revolution.
Thank you so much, Ocean. I just so appreciate being here, and I hope that everybody can just live the healthiest lives that they can live without harming others in the process.
Thank you, Brenda.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 23 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then we have an offer to share. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus resources. If you like, you can also get CDs, members-only courses, and a lot more. This empowerment package is available for a major discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thanks so much for joining us in the Food Revolution. We have a pre-recorded message from Dick Dubois. Dick's life and health have been profoundly impacted by the work of two of the doctors in this summit, Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn and our next guest, who we will be hearing from shortly, Dr. T. Colin Campbell. I asked Dick if he'd be willing to share some words with us, and this is what he had to say.
My name is Dick Dubois, and this is my food revolution story. I am a healthy 62-year-old. I am 5 feet 6 inches tall and weigh 140 pounds and consider myself an endurance athlete. I love being fit and active and regularly participate in many types of athletic activities. Although I have been a runner for more than 35 years and have completed 25 marathons and ultramarathons, I was not always healthy. I grew up on a dairy farm and was very overweight as a child and weighed 80 pounds more than I do now when I graduated from high school. When I started exercising regularly in the 1970s, I lost weight and was able to keep most of it off while training, but I was still overweight. I ate a very high-fat diet that included meat, dairy, eggs, and a lot of junk food. Even though I had a family history, with both my parents having heart disease, I thought that I was immune from the disease because of my exercise routine. In 2004, at the age of 53, I started getting exercise-induced angina. When I started running, I would feel tightness in my chest and discomfort in my neck and arms. At first, I tried to ignore it, but it continually progressed to the point where I couldn't run more than 100 yards without being in significant pain. With the encouragement of my wife, we decided that I had to see a cardiologist. In September 2005, I had an angiogram that showed I had multiple blockages in my coronary arteries, with the worst an 80% blockage at the origin of the left circumflex and the left anterior descending artery, better known as the widowmaker. My cardiologist was concerned that angioplasty or stenting could be fatal, so he scheduled bypass surgery with a surgeon at the Cleveland Clinic. As luck would have it, in the same year, I read the China study by Dr. Colin Campbell, and I visited Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn at his home in Cleveland. I came to realize that there might be alternatives to having open-heart surgery. I made the decision, even though my surgeon tried to talk me out of it, to postpone the bypass procedure for 3 months and give the whole food plant-based diet a chance. The results were remarkable. 4 weeks after changing my diet, I had a follow-up lipid profile done. My total cholesterol had dropped from over 200 to 101, and the LDL cholesterol dropped from the high 90s to 49. I started to see significant weight loss, and during the first 3 months, lost over 45 pounds. I had gotten to a weight I had literally not seen since I was in grade school. I started jogging again within a couple of months, and saw a definite reduction in the amount of angina. I canceled my bypass surgery. A follow-up angiogram in 2010 showed one lesion, a 60% blockage, had been reduced by half to 30%. The large 80% blockage had not shown significant reduction. Dr. Esselstyn's explanation was that lesion was probably very old and fibrous and may never go away. Most importantly, I was free of any symptoms of heart disease, and the angina had completely subsided. Today, 8.5 years after reading Dr. Campbell's book and starting the whole food plant-based diet under the guidance of Dr. Esselstyn, I feel that I am the healthiest and most fit that I have been in my entire life. I am exercising at a high level again and started participating in triathlons and completed my first half Ironman 70.3 this past summer, as well as completing 4 half marathons and running my fastest time since the late 1990s. I think it goes without saying that Dr. Colin Campbell's book and Dr. Esselstyn's work have changed my life, but even more so, I feel that they have saved my life. Thank you for hearing my story. I hope it can be an inspiration to you, too. No matter how sick you may be, there is always hope, and it is never too late to make a change for the better.
Now here comes another pre-recorded testimonial. This one comes from Dr. Pat Spensley. Pat is a family practice doctor in Newburgh, Oregon, whose participation in the 2013 Food Revolution Summit helped inspire him to make powerful changes that led him to lose 50 pounds and transform his medical practice. Here is Dr. Spensley.
Hi, my name is Pat Spensley. I'm a family practice doctor. I'm 51 years old, and I practice in a small community office called Villa Medical in Newburgh, Oregon. As I learned through the Food Revolution interviews that John Robbins performed, the things that really impacted you and I in our regular everyday life, I realized that the nutritional training that I got in medical school was just completely inadequate to function as a effective preventative physician, and the information that I learned at the Food Revolution not only changed my own personal lifestyle, but has helped me be much more effective as a communicator, as a physician. Brenda and I have been following a plant-based nutrition program now for a little over a year. I initially made the effort to change because of health reasons. I was suffering from asthma and using a very expensive injection that was given in my arms every 2 weeks, and still suffering from asthma bad enough to need to use prednisone several times over a year's period of time. I enabled myself to eat more plants, and in doing so, realized that the animal-based foods were just not to my liking. My health improved. My energy level is much better. I've lost over 50 pounds, and I feel that I'm going to live a longer, healthier life. As a physician, when people ask me prior to learning the material that John Robbins introduced me to, I was only able to provide patients with advice about medications, perhaps a referral to see a dietitian. Now I'm able to talk to them with enthusiasm about osteoporosis, about preventing cancer, about how to stay away from being diabetic, hypertensive, obese, to deal with their cholesterol in an effective way with a far less reliance on the drugs and the procedures. I feel that I am much more healthy. I've lost over 50 pounds. My energy level couldn't be better. I'm now able to swim 20,000 yards every week. I look and feel better, and I think I'm going to live a far healthier life.
If you'd like to express your opinions on what you've been hearing or find out what other people are saying, we invite you to post and engage in the comments section at the bottom of our broadcasts page. Our next presentation will be an interview with China Study Director and best-selling author Dr. T. Colin Campbell. It starts at the top of the hour, and until then, here's some music from our friend Bruce Beckvar.